Hello, and welcome to OEG Voices.
OEG Voices.
OEG Voices.
OEG Voices.
A new podcast bringing to you the voices and ideas
of open educators from around the world.
OEG Voices is
produced by Open Education Global,
a member-based
nonprofit organization
supporting the development and use
of open education globally.
Learn more about us
at oeglobal.org.
There's much to take in at a global level.
We hope to bring you closer
to how open education is working
by hearing the stories of practitioners
told in their own voices.
Each episode introduces you
to a global open educator,
and we invite you to later engage in conversation with them
in our OEG Connect community.
It's not a meeting, it's a podcast. Well, welcome everybody. We have a special session going on here during Open Education Week, kind of an open mic session for recording a podcast of OEG Voices. And I've been really excited to do this, and I really want to thank our guest Rajiv for being willing to come in and have like a session where we haven't told him what we're talking about. But I would also turn it over to my colleague Marcella Morales, who will maybe introduce Rajiv and why he's here.
Well, welcome everyone. Very happy to be here, and thank you, Rajiv, for giving us this time. I'm going to go back to the why we started with this conversation, which is the winning of your this year for leadership category, which I think was a long deserving. Oh, there you have it. Yes, and actually we were going to ask for a picture with the award because we want to put it front and forward on the website. But yes, we just wanted to continue the celebration and to acknowledge the many accomplishments that you have been doing for the open education community. And there's so many things that we can talk about that we want to go back all the way back to say why and when did you get involved in open education, like very initial questions and what keeps you motivated so many years after. But we can get into that. So that's pretty much going in addition what Alan is saying. We just wanted to have an informal conversation with you and open the floor. If there's anything that you want to share with us and with the community, we are able to do that as well. And very happy to hear. I also read the Twitter comment that was made today, which I think was fascinating, these new ideas and aspects that we are standing up for what open means. But I'll slip in a few questions around that a little bit later on.
Maybe we should also, because we've never done this before, we have like open guests, and I just want to ask our guests to say hello.
Yes, we should do that, absolutely.
So I'll start with Tricia, just introduce yourself and where you are and maybe why you came.
So hi, everybody. I'm Trish Bonner, and I am with Loyalist College here in Ontario. And why did I come here? Just because I think it's a great topic, and I have a little crush on Rajiv. So what a great time to be here. I just think he's been a great inspiration. So he's been a wonderful inspiration for a lot of open and the opportunity to sit in is, thank you for that.
Well, stand in line for the crushes next fall.
Okay. Hi, everyone. I'm Paul Stacey. I'm the Executive Director of Open Education Global. We're the host for OE Week, but I've known Rajiv for many years because we both live in Vancouver, and I've just been a huge admirer of his work and the way that he has progressed that work. It's like he keeps kind of raising the bar and elevating the game such that his institution now is really a lead institution. It's not just him, but it's really his whole institution has become a real leader in open education. It's just totally impressive. And I think in many ways, that trajectory of kind of the progressive advancement of open that Rajiv has shown is a model, I think, for others that could follow in his footsteps.
And now maybe a little hello from Solange.
Oh, I'm really excited to be here today to be part of the conversation. My name is Solange Lalonde, and I'm director of RMTL Consulting Incorporated. I'm based out of Calgary, and I am absolutely, fascinated with with open resources, and I'm, you know, in my own work and in my own research, trying to situate what I'm sharing where and how. And I think more and more people are having these conversations, and I carry Métis ancestry. And so from Indigenous perspectives, I'm always looking at, you know, how can we contribute to our communities? And I see so many opportunities to align a lot of what our communities are doing and learning more, learning every day. So thank you for hosting this.
Excellent. Thank you for joining us. This is really, I like this format, Marcella. Maybe we should do this more often.
Yes, we should. Definitely. Love it.
So Rajiv, we all have crushes on you. How does that feel?
That's very funny. Well, I have to say, so Alan, of everybody in this call, you're the one person who spent the night with me in Phoenix one point. So
I think you have to. That's right. Exactly. We shared a hotel room. I forgot about that. And it was great.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, so obviously I'm thrilled to be here. Hello, everyone. Bonjour tout le monde. Buenos dias. Namaskar. I'm really, really thrilled to be joining you from the traditional ancestral unceded territories of the Squamish First Nation in what's North Vancouver, BC. I was already scribbling away furiously. I feel like it's an open-ended conversation with open guests. And before we started the call, Paul has this beautiful, colorful mobile that's hanging from his ceiling, and he described it as loving the way in which it makes the invisible visible. And I think maybe that's part of what this conversation could be about in some ways. But obviously, I was thrilled to be nominated and with this award. But it's also a strange thing, because I think, as many of you will know, working in this space, I've been thinking a lot about this in terms of, you know, why did all of this happen? The traction at my institution, the way the movement is going. And I think, I feel like it's a function of a couple of things. And I'd love your thoughts about this. But on the one hand, I'm thinking about all of the different ways in which, you know, community has made this happen. So for example, you know, the responsiveness, the openness of the community. When I first was at the OpenEd conference in Vancouver in 20 something or the other, I saw Robin DeRosa was in the room on Twitter, and I'd never met her. And I tweeted at her, DM'd her, and I said, "Hey, are you here? Yes. Where are you? I'm at the New Hampshire table in the front. Oh, can I come see you? Yes." And you know, and from there, we just ended up having this, you know, decade long kind of intellectual love affair where we just keep growing together. But it was her openness and invitation, right? And in England, when I was visiting one time, the publisher just put out the first open book in 2017, and it was Martin Weller's publisher. That's how we'd found Ubiquity Press. And I was like, they have, I'm arriving on the weekend, won't be able to grab a copy. He was like, "Oh, no problem. I will hoof it down." So he walked several blocks, picked up the first print copy from the publisher, brought it to the pub where we celebrated together. There's all these karaoke meetings that are wrapped up in all of our conferences. And even the most recent Open at the Margins book, I think, is a good illustration of just, on the one hand, it's the community is so open that it's enabled a lot of collaborations that have enabled my work to advance, but also the work of my institution, of the movement. And I think the other piece, which I'm also falsely credited for, I'm falsely credited for the openness of the community and how that amplifies work, is the affordances of openness. It's some of the stuff like, you know, you work on an open textbook in 2013, and all of a sudden people are adapting it in the United States, in New Zealand, in Turkey, in all over the place. And it's like, oh yeah, I played, you know, I was one, you know, paddle in the oar at a certain point in time. And so, you know, it's interesting to me to reflect how much of what might be pointed to as evidence of anything is really a function of the openness of the community, which could easily have not chosen to be that open, in which case the same effort from my perspective would not have gone that far, or the affordances of openness, which allow the same effort to be amplified that dramatically. So I appreciate the love, but I think it's really, in so many ways, a recognition of the openness of the community and the power of the affordances of open licensing, really.
Well, thank you, Rajiv. It's wonderful to hear that. And listening to how passionate you are about open, and I've heard this in your voice from ever since. First of all, I just heard your name, Rajiv, and Rajiv, it kept on popping everywhere. And then I had the fortune to meet you personally. And the one thing that has struck me always is how passionate you are when you speak about openness, and that transcends your work. And it's always lovely to hear that.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think that that is true for many of us. I think one of the interesting things about this work is, I mean, in many cases, I find that we're talking as advocates sometimes about a third party, right? By talking about the plight of a student or systems of oppression. And many of the voices are sometimes speaking with an attempt to genuinely understand those voices and recognizing those voices. But I do think there's a number of us, and the recent volume Open at the Margins collects a lot of these voices that can speak through a firsthand lens. And perhaps what might help over here is, you know, I don't think I ever connected the dots very clearly until I really started thinking and speaking about this. But, you know, having experienced directly, you know, this idea of access to education being such a critical aspect of being able to support social economic mobility, to be able to unlock human potential, none of this is a theoretical construct for me. It's very much my lived experience. So, I mean, it may be that that's part of what comes through. And that's where I think, you know, storytelling, including, you know, as in this conversation, is powerful. And so I think with many advocates, we can talk about the data, we can talk about the serious situations that we're trying to redress, the barriers we're trying to eradicate. But at the heart of it, I think the most powerful voices are ones that speak authentically from mm-hmm. from their lived experiences.
Absolutely. And actually, I do wonder, you have been involved with open education for so long, and you have been participating in projects like the Open Pedagogy Notebook and also the CTC degrees. But I wonder, from all the initiatives that you have been involved in, which one do you think that has generated the most impact, that you have been most passionate about, that you say, this is the one seed that I planted that had really grown into something that's the most interesting to you?
That's a really hard question. I really don't know. You know, in some ways, I think anytime I'm involved in OER development, in some sense, there's the cascading, growing ripple effect impact that I will never see. Nobody necessarily goes upstream to say, oh, by the way, you know, when you threw this pebble in the water, I'm now, you know, involved in this ripple that's like, you know, 3 miles downstream. Nobody, you don't necessarily hear about that. So I think there's a lot of unknown impact that is exciting to sort of dream about and imagine. I wonder where this OER went. But, you know, I suspect it's more about the community. And I think probably the work with Robin, because she makes everything I do better. She makes my ideas better. So I think the idea of the Open Pedagogy Notebook was probably helpful because it came also at a time where the community was maturing in the sense of the focus was very deliberately expanding within the institutions from OER and OER adoption and creation to also considering the pedagogical affordances, considering the multiple pathways into open education, what might, you know, invite faculty, what might keep them there, what might excite them there, what might excite students. And it's funny because even when I think about, I think an example of this is even when we talk about on my campus, print on demand, it's a very important option to have for open textbooks. The reality is it's not used by a huge proportion of students. Like it's a significant minority who are interested in the print copies. But the option to have a print copy is more important than how many people take advantage of it, because that's what makes it possible for many faculty who, you know, will wax lyrically about the smell of paper to consider adopting an open textbook. And I think with the Open Pedagogy Notebook and with Open Pedagogy mm-hmm. work in general, that's part of it is, it doesn't matter. We don't have to have a library of like 1,000 examples on the Open Pedagogy Notebook to spark that interest of possibilities and make it real from talking about. Theoretically, we could do something that avails of the affordances to, oh, that's what it looks like in practice. So, and I think, so having a space which invites community, what is theoretical to become real, as in, you know, Paul's mobile, again, it makes the invisible possibilities very tangible. Probably something I'm pretty proud of. It's something I'd love to see grow, of course, but any space that you invite community and in which, you know, community can basically occupy, run, drive the space.
Can you give us like a window into like, what are you doing right today? What in your role, like what's on your schedule today after this? Like, and what's on your plate that you're trying to wrestle with right now?
Oh gosh. Well, I can tell I'm going to read right from my schedule. So at about half an hour after this meeting finishes, I'm involved in a few initiatives. And it's interesting talking about increasing focus on the values of openness, which have connected anyway previously to issues of equitable access and therefore equity and issues of social justice in a wider lens. You think about Cheryl Hodgkinson-Williams' beautiful keynote at the last OE Global in Milan, and that framework about political, economic, and social justice. So we're having conversations. We have anti-racism task forces that I serve on and an EDI action plan steering committee at my institution. And we're talking about strengthening the connections between those and the faculty development work. So in my new role, developing a new comprehensive framework for faculty development that embeds inclusive teaching training within it. And we're looking to sort of strengthen that anti-racist teaching practices competency within what is not going to be considered an optional enhancement, but what we think is a competency if you're going to be an educator today. After that, we're having chats about where we're going with micro-credentials in terms of open recognition. And then after that, we're talking about, there's a third meeting about prior learning assessment and recognition. So either way, I think, trying to underline, underscore, enhance, make more explicit the equity, justice, inclusivity of our work, trying to, and then find different ways to recognize what people already know and make the different pathways into and out of higher education more flexible and open. That's my day.
That's quite a day. Rajiv, can I ask a question? I've been so impressed. Like in the open education space, I can imagine and remember and admire lots of tea who are doing exemplary, the extent to which they often can change the culture of their institution and move the whole institution in this direction is sometimes limited. But in your case, you've succeeded. And I wonder if you could share some of the ways in which you were able to do that.
Sure, I'd be happy to. And I also want to acknowledge that I see Una Daly is with us. Again, one of the great heroes of the open ed movement. Glad to have you with us, Una. In some ways, I think when I began publicly kind of advocating for this work, it was funny because it was almost like there was the platform of the Davids, right? Like it was like we had David Carnahan and David Wiley and David Porter. And I made a joke at one of my early speeches. I was like, by the way, Rajiv is Hindi for David. And it isn't. But, it felt like it was novel enough to not have another David being speaking. And mind you, that's also an indication of the impact of the work of the collective Davids, that their work effectively became canonical for the field. So I don't know. I mean, I think there's a few things. I don't think it's like what I said for the OER, the openness of the community and the affordances of openness, where your effort is either invited into places where you wouldn't be able to as an individual, or it is amplified in ways that you can't control yourself as a function of the open licensing. In my case, I think the invitation comes by the nature of the institution and my context. So we have a university president at KPU who, as soon as he got to KPU, 9 years ago or so, was a fierce advocate for this. He came from an institution and lots of experience from Athabasca and Empire State College and places that I'd really experimented quite a bit with open practices. And he was very eager. So he and the provost at the time is really understood openness. I think it was more a case of waiting until the time was right. They also knew that this is not something that ought to be mandated, forced, top-down kind of approach. And it was waiting for the ground to want to demand it. And so I think it was this happy marriage of grassroots interest that obviously I, but many of my colleagues were really stirring up and vocalizing and trying to push, let's do the OER, let's do some research on it, let's experiment with open pedagogy, let's do all of these things and start talking about it and writing about it. And so I think it was really a function of the institutional hospitability, the support of senior leadership. I would not understate the contribution, the impact of that, because it made it so that I didn't feel at any point like I would run afoul of anybody when I was experimenting. It was encouraged, it was supported. I mean, I got internal research grants to study this stuff in 2014 at the institution. So that encouragement was very powerful. And I think many of us are trying to build and enhance those institutional systems to make, you know, whether it's tenure and promotion on, in some places or something else, mechanisms, funding, training. We're trying to make the environment more hospitable. But of course, in the broader context, BC Campus, I mean, none of this happens without BC Campus, right? I mean, they played a huge, huge role. And of course, Paul, I think that's when we met, is when you were with BC Campus as well. But yeah, I mean, I think in terms of allowing institutions to do this work without having to run the take on the institutional risk or make the institutional investment back in the day when the Open Textbook Project was launched in 2012 or so in British Columbia. So they've been critical in making even the institutional investments, which had to come at the right time with the grassroots interest, palatable, because they sort of socialized it, acclimatized it, supported it tangibly, and played that important role to help institutions figure out, what do we need? How do we do this? Where's the expertise? I would say, you know, there's a huge, huge bedrock. That's BC Campus. There's definitely a little mountain on top of that in terms of the impact of the leadership and everything else. And so if I plant a flag on top of that, like, you know, that's, you know, there's a whole lot that I'm standing on that made this hospitable. And then, of course, the whole goal at this point, like for many of us, is, you know, we have these incredible other advocates who follow, right? Because you do try and make it so that leading edge is not, you know, the cliches, you don't want to make it the bleeding edge, right? And so now we have people who are increasingly well-known, like Arlie Crothers, our open education teaching fellow, is doing incredible work. And Alan has helped adapt some of her open pedagogy created student textbook affordability games into H5P for us. And Melissa Ashman, who's our Open Ed Research Fellow, and Uruj Nizami, our Open Ed Strategist. And we've got this team of incredible people in the library, and Caroline Daniels, Kaya Klein, and Todd Mundell. But the point is, you may know me, but there's a whole lot of people around and growing and climbing on top of me now. And the whole point of this is, you know, we become redundant. You know, so perhaps at some point, you know, somebody will say, oh, my name translates to Rajiv or something, but I'm increasingly redundant at this point, which is fabulous.
Excellent, thank you. Maybe we should pass along the mic, maybe to Tricia or Solange, if you want to address some questions to Una.
I'm just enjoying the conversation with Rajiv, and reliving a little bit of that early days of the BC Campus, and what an amazing project the Open BC Campus has been. Just really a role model for all of us.
Yeah, I think they just tweeted, in fact, yesterday, I think, they've now crossed $22 million, I believe, in purely because of OER. And of course, they've helped so much. I know at KPU, we've focused on the ZTC approach and partnering across the institutions. But yeah, right from the repository, it's not even just what they're doing, but they're doing it in the right way, right? Sort of supporting various projects now in BC about indigenization, making sure from the get-go that they were prioritizing accessibility with that guide. So I think that's what I admire, is there's a lot of people who've done a lot of good things, and it's hard to be able to think about it proactively enough, carefully enough, to do it in the right way and get so much of it right. And BC Campus has got a whole lot of this right. I think they deserve a lot of credit.
Can you talk some about, like, I mean, the current like situation for students at KPU and where the work you have done has played a factor or not? I mean, what's the student experience? I mean, because, you know, I'm kind of removed from that, and I'm really eager, you know, as you alluded to, really being in touch with it.
Yeah. I mean, of course, you know, this last year has been interesting. Like in most places, we've seen an acceleration in the adoption of open resources over the pandemic, of course, because, you know, flexible access, affordable access, especially at a time where students are struggling to get employment and finances are even more tricky. So a lot of students have appreciated and benefited from it. But I would say increasingly, and part of the sort of institutionalization, systematization of this is we get a lot more data now to sort of gauge the impact. So back in the day, we used to run these research studies where we would randomly assign sections and we could say, oh, you know, we can see the impact on outcomes for the same instructor teaching the same course, with the same design, the same assessments with an open book versus with an incumbent commercial book. But now, I mean, goodness. So we hear from students about the degree to which KPU's zero textbook cost program has influenced their decision to come to the institution. And it's quite staggering. So it starts there. And then we look at things like, well, now that they can search for ZTC courses in the timetable at the point of registration, does this impact registration, seat enrollment, waitlists, The answer is yes, 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 it does. It's quite significantly. And then does it affect, you know, the outcomes in the course? Absolutely. Withdrawal rates, drop rates, failure rates, all of these are being significantly affected. So I can look at the sort of flow through rate effectively, the impact on the institution of enrollment, performance, and persistence, and that's significant. But the other part, of course, is the growth in all of the open pedagogy stuff. And that's a little, you know, I can't give you data quite in the same way, but I can talk to you about, you know, the number of projects, open textbook projects, and introduction to Canadian tax was a very recent open pedagogy, student-authored open textbook. A lot of those kinds of projects coming through the pipe. Some of it connects with Montgomery Colleges, and now we partner with them on the UNSDG Open Pedagogy Fellowship. So it sort of connects these bigger global challenges with the open pedagogy work to make it even more meaningful, not just in an abstract, oh, somebody will reuse this resource that's valuable, but it's directing it very specifically to tackle this challenge. So I would say there's growth in all of the above, and I can tell you about, you know, on paper, we have, you know, now about 850 unique TC. We've seen students at KPU save more than $5 million at this point. And for a large institution, that's maybe not a lot of money. For an institution that has a maximum class size of 35, it takes a long, long list of 35 student sections to get to $5 million. So, but yeah, I mean, I would say it's more along the lines now of the culture, the identity of the institution. So increasingly, I think, you know, people are thinking about it in terms of, if you're a faculty member, I know this is what KPU does, and there's encouragement and support for this. You don't have to do it, but you can. And so I think that's the piece that I'm interested in, is if we can now deliver on that reputation that is growing and again, make sure that we're able to address those difficult questions about whether it's digital redlining or accessibility or inclusion, right? Free is not enough. Free is not the goal of open. Free is one of the aspects of open in terms of affordability. And so I think that's the piece, is trying to advantage at this point of where we are in the movement to try and play that leadership role, because other institutions hopefully will be able to build on the lessons that we are in the process of learning.
Fabulous. Like, I'm writing down all these quotes that you're giving me. So thank you for that. And Trisha has a question and a little bit of a follow-up to what you said. Trisha's asking, how do we capitalize on the momentum of this uptake? And I'm wondering too, the way you described, you know, the impact of the ZTC programs is like, is this now part of Kwantlen's like reputation? Like, people know about Kwantlen because this is something that they offer to students.
I think a lot of people found out about Kwantlen in this way, and it's nice because, I mean, first of all, we're an open access institution that focuses on teaching excellence. So questions of equitable access and pedagogical innovation are very naturally aligned with the mission, mandate, and strategic planning of the institution. So first of all, none of this is a stretch for the identity, and it is explicitly an identity, right? So it's, we have the institution, and open education is one of them at the highest level. And yes, we have, yeah, this point, I think seven ZTC programs, including a full Bachelor of Arts degree in general studies. So it's quite fabulous. I mean, a student could literally take the whole bachelor's degree with no textbook costs, and hopefully with a whole lot of open pedagogy along the way. But the question is really fascinating. I mean, the momentum on the uptake of OER, I think it's, I mean, I keep thinking about this in a sort of heterogeneous way, because you want to do many things. You want to, on the one hand, I think when I entered the movement, I remember, Alan, you had a blog post. You remember this? Where you were sort of saying there's this mythical beast, this animal out there about OER adaptation and reuse. And I hear that this is technically possible, but like, where is this, this mythical beast? And I remember I submitted a video to you. A lot of people did as well. It's like, no, this is actually happening. Here's an example of how we've done this. And I think that's that part of the risk, is I've seen a lot of institutions, and particularly I would say sometimes it's the larger institutions that are, I continue to see, are less interested in reuse. They're less interested in adapting, adopting what others have created, and they're interested in creating their own, which is fine, right? Great. If you have the resources and the capacity, it actually helps the movement greatly. But ultimately, what makes this sustainable is you want to grow that reuse. So I would say, you know, when we talk about momentum, I'd love to see a lot more momentum in terms of pure adoptions and localizing and adaptations and updates to sort of capitalize on the existing, you know, bedrock of OER that's already there. And then, of course, taking things further and creating more as well. But so for me, if there's adoptions already taking place, the momentum to capitalize is incremental, right? You can adapt it to the local context, like even in a small way, minor adaptations before going into major adaptations. I think the other piece is where there is that opportunity. one of the nice things about open, I think, is it's providing this bridge between institutions that are so traditionally competitive. So, you know, if I can reach out to colleagues at other institutions and say, hey, look, in BC, we know we need a, I'm just making this up right now, British Columbia, or let's say geography in a British Columbia context. We have this open textbook now, by the way, but a few years ago, we didn't. But that would have been a great example of where, look, we do not have something existing. All of us could benefit from this, not just one institution. Let's collaborate and make this happen. And of course, BC Campus catalyzed and brought that group together and made that happen. So I would say a lot more collaboration institutionally in terms of creation, a lot more temporal collaboration in terms of adopting what's been created elsewhere and adapting what's been created elsewhere. So for me, those are key things. And then for students, of course, doing one thing that we did and I encourage other people to do is you can have 100 OER based courses, but if you're able to add 3 or 4 that enable you to have full pathways that students can complete through that, instead of it just being a sort of a smorgasbord of it's sort of random, if you might find one here or there. So the more programmatic approach to OER creation, I think, is really helpful for students. Yeah, so a couple of thoughts over there. I've seen comments in the chat as well.
Yeah, this is good. Tanya has a couple questions, and Trish is asking, like, one of the challenges is supporting part-time or adjunct faculty, which is huge.
Yeah, definitely. So I have to say, one of the things, there's many reasons why I love my institution. One of the latest reasons I'm happy, very happy to say, is that what, you know, we call non-regular faculty, what other people call adjunct faculty, for example, are now on the same scale, the same pay scale.
Wow.
as regular faculty, which is lovely. It's not the case, I know, in many, many institutions. That's one part of it. But yeah, I mean, supporting professional development, you know, allowing opportunities for contingent faculty to get involved in OER creation adaptation projects, those kinds of things.
People want to know if you're hiring, but
constantly.
I wanted to ask a question, Rajiv. I happened to be at a wonderful talk this morning with Dr. Jasmine Roberts, talking about. I know, amazing. Talking about supporting faculty, part-time faculty, particularly, you know, at our community colleges, our full-time faculty, usually it's about 80% are white, so not very diverse, 20% are otherwise. But the part-time faculty actually tend to be much more representative of our student population. And I wonder how KPU, I don't know what your statistics are, but I wonder how you're addressing that, because I do think it's really important to have those voices in the open education and supporting the students as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's interesting because we're in the midst of, in fact, I got the email earlier this morning as part of the work of the Equity, Diversity, Inclusion Steering Action Plan Steering Committee, we're actually beginning a big data collection push. There's the Canadian Center for Diversity and Inclusion. They're helping us with a diversity meter. So we don't have institutional level data at this point of things like racial background, for example. They even have a sense of where are we at. I can tell you anecdotally, certainly the student body is incredibly diverse. And when you look at the faculty, yeah, it's a little less diverse. And then, of course, and so on. But to have the actual data and especially how that lines up in different groups of stakeholders, you know, staff versus faculty, regular versus non-regular faculty, I don't know yet, but I think collecting those data is a really important first step for us as we then you know, build our action plan for the future. But yeah, I do think it's a trend that is perhaps more severe south of the border, but it's not something to ignore even over here in Canada. The sort of adjunctification of higher ed is a real phenomenon, of course. And I know in many, many cases, it is a function of many things. And we are often focused on a piece of affordability, but, you know, the defunding of higher education at the state level, at the provincial level, for example, the sort of push towards internationalization, the push towards, you know, whether it's privatizing bookstores, there's a whole number of things that are happening that I think are amplifying existing inequities in society, right? And so, yeah, I mean, I think you're recognizing a phenomenon that I certainly do as well. I don't have data from KPU to speak to this, but yeah, I do think it's something that does need attention. And with Jasmine, Jasmine is like, you know, amazing. I remember this was OE Global in Cape Town, Paul. And she spoke in one of those small rooms. And you know, she was a new instructor. She'd just written this book on crisis communications, and she was telling her story. I was in the back of the room. I was messaging Sarah Cohen from the OpenEd Network. I was like, oh my God, we have another one. We found one. Because you know, this powerful, naturally powerful storytelling faculty voice, desperately needed. And she's a gem. And she's written really articulately about this issue. But I think the secondary problem is this in open ed is to connect with what Alan was talking about, because if you have the majority of your regular faculty who are perhaps more likely to be in terms of their background from groups that have enjoyed a fair degree of privilege economically and otherwise, there's an ideology that's associated with that privilege, and then if it's those groups that get to be involved in all of the OER creation projects, that ideology then at a more subtle level, a more difficult level to extract, gets embedded in the ideology of the text that we're then running around the world saying, hey, we've got this wonderful OER. And so from, you know, and this goes back to Cheryl Hodgkinson-Williams framework with Henry Trotter, is it is important to have knowledge creation be equitable. And so the issue of adjunctification and, more diverse scholars and voices being able to fully equitably participate in knowledge creation on the side of OER has a big impact, even in terms of students being able to identify their experiences and identities in the text that they're reading, right, in terms of the available OER. So I think this is a problem that has multiple effects, some of them really obvious and some of them really subtle, but no less important.
This is so good. And I want to recognize too that you've got a full afternoon of meetings, but I want to make sure we get a picture of you with your trophy. You flashed it. I need to get a snapshot. So do you mind holding it up so we could pose and hang on. Let me get you. I don't have you centered.
So I have to say this was really fun. And I hope folks know the story of this, because this was super creative, right? This was 3D printed from, somebody fill in the gaps over here, please.
From the Fab Lab in UNED, Costa Rica.
Costa Rica?
An open Fab Lab,
wow,
we should say. And it was printed there with, in Costa Rica. In UNED, it's the Universidad Estatal de Educación a Distancia in Costa Rica.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, designed by our colleague, Mario Badia. So hold it up still, like you're waving it around. I need a good photo of you.
Well, yeah, so. But I'm going to say, so this came flat in a beautiful box that itself was beautiful. And then I got to sort of take it out and pop it in over here. But yeah, this was really creative and fun.
Okay, hang on. I need one more.
There it is.
Okay, good smile. Beautiful.
But yeah, this is my Pura Vida trophy. That's good to know it comes from Costa Rica.
I don't know if you have time, but Marcel and I were also curious about, you just tweeted this morning, taking a rather critical stand on certain companies and your opportunity to speak at a conference. Do you mind sharing a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I can speak to it a little bit. I mean, it's an interesting thing. I would say I first have to confess that I both in terms of workload and also, you know, people don't need to hear the same voices over and over. So I decline a lot of speaking engagements, but I accepted a few. And some of these are sort of legacy. So there's a conference I was meant to speak at last spring, and then the pandemic happened, and so it couldn't be in person. So we deferred it, and then it was deferred to this year, virtual, all right. And so there were, you know, existing agreements and that were set up somewhere along the way. I learned that there's this sponsorship question. And it's interesting because whenever I negotiate on, you know, somebody approaches to speak, and I think it's on my website as well, I have some basic questions about, you know, If it's going to be recorded, can it please be CC BY? Usually there's no issue over there. You know, if it's a series of keynote speakers or a series of panelists or whatever, you know, it's like, all right, let's talk about the diversity of the panel. And sometimes, you know, you have allies in the program committee, and what really helps them is if the speaker does the job of advocating with them so that they are not just the minority on the program committee to say, hey, you know, it's something that it's a powerful position to be in when you're approached to speak. And that allows you to push organizations in a direction that in this case aligns with the values of what I think are common values within the open movement, right? About diversity and inclusion and equity. And so that's a negotiation that I'm used to doing. What I hadn't thought of doing, this is a big lesson learned for me, is to now look at the question of sponsorships and who's sponsoring and are they problematic? And to be honest, this is something I've thought about a little bit in the past in the context of open ed. Sometimes it's almost been fun to take advantage of opportunities where I've spoken at small kind of regional or institutional events where maybe a couple of the sponsors happen to be commercial textbook companies, the same ones that have been price gouging students for years and profiteering off, you know, food insecurity and similar kind of reprehensible behavior with, you know, cosmetic changes to so-called new editions of textbooks. And I'm going to rail for a little bit, so I'm going to rail this in. But the point is, you can take that approach. Where you know, you can take that sponsorship and use that platform and use it to critique and bring more attention to that business model. And sometimes, yes, there's some sick pleasure one can derive out of taking their sponsorship dollars to do that. But with other cases, it gets more complicated. And so I guess what I'm saying is I think you can legitimately speak, use the platform in a responsible way to bring attention to these issues, or you can withdraw. And you know, I think when it comes to ed tech, there's so much work in ethical ed tech, and I am going to be giving a talk at the end of April at BCNet about specifically ethical ed tech. But there's people like, you know, Audrey Waters and Jesse Stommel and others that have written and shared rubrics and frameworks with which to interrogate the ed tech platforms that we use. It's a big, important discussion, particularly in the context of data privacy and the sort of unseen consequences of the platforms that we mandate our students to use. I mean, imagine for a moment, just to share one example, you know, if an institution mandates that students use a particular homework quizzing platform that's associated with a commercial textbook. And in Canada, that's an issue if the servers are located, let's say, in the United States, where in British Columbia, we have fairly stringent privacy legislation. But it's not difficult, it's not that abstractly theoretical to say, could then the digital footprint that we're mandating our students leave as a function of their homework be used to identify and perhaps deport dreamers or their families? This is not a theoretical idea. This is a very real possibility. And so it's starting to think about the ethics of edtech in terms of what we use, what we support, what data we're collecting, and being more responsible. And so I think there are edtech companies that, you know, the damage that they do, I mean, it's bad enough if we're talking about, you know, price gouging and food insecurity and profiting off those. But if we're now talking about technologies that are in some cases inherently ableist, inherently racist, incredibly damaging in terms of the mistrust and the model of mistrust that's being perpetrated in higher ed with very dubious, questionable claims about their efficacy, with questions about their, not just information security, but privacy. As well, and of course, equity in terms of tech and where we're leading things. So I think, you know, I have my personal philosophy about this. We've certainly had discussions at my institution about this, at you know, our governance bodies about the pedagogical and ethical dimensions of surveillance technologies. But for me, you know, it's a very difficult situation to be able to walk that tightrope where it would take a lot emotionally, cognitively, to be able to, you know, manage the conversation leading up to a keynote and then having any kind of implicit endorsement of that platform. So I think it was a personal choice for me to withdraw. I have to say I was very, very grateful to have such, you know, clear leadership and responsiveness from the organization in question to allow me the flexibility. They understood the issue immediately, no hesitation, immediately gave me a few options to work with. So, you know, I would just say that I think it is very possible to responsibly use that platform and go ahead and speak. I'm dealing with a few other personal stresses right now that meant that it was a little too hard for me to do it at this point. So I chose to withdraw, and I was glad to have the option to defer my talk. I also feel at this point, after the sort of response on Twitter over the last 12 hours or so, that it feels like a little bit of a Streisand effect situation, because I didn't give a keynote at this event that talked about surveillance technology, but the conversation's happening in a pretty wide way about it, perhaps as a result of not talking about it at the keynote. So, you know, mission accomplished without having to walk that tightrope, perhaps.
I think you just demonstrated why you got that award.
Well, I don't know. But, you know, it's, I will say with awards, they're really funny, right? Because I know so many people through grad school, through all aspects of life who work, you know, just as hard, twice as hard, and do not get recognized. So I think it is important to sort of know that, you know, when you get an award, it's not necessarily about you. When you don't get an award, it's not necessarily about you. Like, I've been on award selection committees where people use the heuristics of, oh, you know, they've got a bunch of awards already. We're going to use that as a heuristic, you know. So people tend to offer more cookies to people when they have cookie crumbs around their mouth. That's one lesson that I've learned. But that also means that there's power and privilege that you can use to push from those platforms. So when you are being approached to speak, right, there's that power that you can, it's a power imbalance, but as an individual, you can move the organization that approach you. I think anything like that, where an individual is being singled out for something, whether it's an award or to speak at an event, it just gives you that opportunity to do something that is bigger than you. And that's, I think, maybe that's the invisible, indivisible in the open ed movement, right? You have that power to do something that's much bigger than you.
I think from where we are standing, the recognition, it's more than well deserved. So you're being very humble, Rajiv. And I also, going back to what you were saying about your Twitter comment this morning, is that there's a congruency element that it's very easy to talk about open and sell the idea of openness is something that everybody usually adopts and likes, but then having the actions to back up that idea is usually hard, and you do that very well. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. That's very kind of you to say. I think, again, this is part of that responsibility is one of the real lessons for me in open ed is, you know, it's like when I was teaching in the classroom, you know, if you have a question in your mind as a student, odds are other people have the same question,
yeah.
Right? And so if you know that, it kind of gives you that responsibility to say, I'll take the risk of being the first person to ask the question, knowing that what I'm actually doing is making it much easier for other people to vocalize questions, right? And so I think that's maybe part of it. So I appreciate it, but I think there's a lot to be grateful for, and yeah. So I will try to, as always, you know, retroactively or prospectively earn the award through the actions to come. But I'm very grateful.
Thank you.
It's been great.
Well, thank you so much, Rajiv, for spending this time with us. I think we'd want to stay here for hours, but you have some things to do, and I want to thank my colleague Marcella and Solange, Tanya, Trisha, Una, and Paul for sitting in on this. And this has been a really enjoyable format. And I'm glad you're game to sort of, you know, freeform the conversation here. This is really exciting.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you, everyone. Take care.
Thank you.
Of course. Thanks for inviting me. And it's lovely to see everybody. And it's been fun to listen to the other podcasts so far, and looking forward to the others.
And we will have some open license music. I found a track called Play from a Free Music Archive from a musician called Kesta. Enjoy it. And we're going to try to get this posted in the next couple hours. And thanks, you, everybody, and have a great day.
Thank you.